From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The human papillomavirus, also called HPV, is highly infectious and a major cause of cervical cancer. Nearly 80 million Americans have it. 14 million contract a new strand every year, mostly through sexual contact. But a new study offers dramatically good news about the prevalence of HPV. The number of teenage girls who are infected has dropped by half in recent years, and medical experts credit the HPV vaccine. But they say the bad news is this: only 1 in 3 American teenagers are fully vaccinated against HPV. Why? This hour on On Point, the HPV vaccine, the science behind it, and the reluctance to embrace it. Later this hour, we'll look at a new push from Bill Gates, who's trying to help the world design a better condom. But first to HPV and this new study. Joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia, is Dr. Lori Markowitz. She's an epidemiologist in the Division of STD Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. She's the lead researcher for the HPV vaccine working group. She's also the lead author of the new study on HPV in teens that is causing such a stir, out this month in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. You can find a link to the study at our website, onpointradio.org. And Dr. Lori Markowitz, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
I want to ask you about this study because it's dramatic. But first, I thought it would be useful to step back for a moment and just give us a little bit of useful background. What is HPV?
Well, HPV is a virus, and it's a sexually transmitted infection. It's the most common sexually transmitted infection in the U.S.
Right. And it's essentially contracted through sexual contact. That's the most common way, right?
Most common, yes. Yeah. And that there's some types of HPV that we call high risk. Those types are associated with some cancers, and then there are other types that are considered low risk, and those are not associated with cancers but other things like genital warts.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about cancer, we're talking about HPV, particular strains of HPV, as being a major cause of cervical cancer in women, right?
Right. Essentially, all cervical cancers are caused by HPV.
Mm-hmm.
And two types, HPV 16 and 18, cause about 70% of all of those cancers.
I see. And how common is HPV? That is, how many people, percentages of people, actually carry HPV, the HPV virus?
Well, I think you gave some numbers at the beginning. I mean, we say that most sexually active women and men will acquire HPV at some time in their sexually active lives. We estimate about 80 million Americans are infected with HPV, and about 14 million new infections occur each year.
So, Dr. Markowitz, take us to this study, and I think the headline is the remarkable effectiveness of the HPV vaccine, correct?
Yes, we found a larger impact than we were expecting. This study was conducted in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Study, or NHANES, and this is a national study that's conducted in the United States. It's unique in that it combines interviews with laboratory and physical examinations, and it evaluates a wide variety of things. We included HPV testing in females as part of this survey in 2003. And so what we did in this paper was compared HPV prevalence in females 14 to 59 years of age in the 4-year period before the start of the HPV vaccination program in the U.S. from 2003 to 2006 with the HPV prevalence in the first 4 years after HPV vaccination was introduced. And what we found was that in 14 to 19-year-olds, the types of HPV that are prevented by the quadrivalent vaccine decreased by more than 50%. And
Did that surprise you? Because that is a truly astounding result, a 50% decrease.
Yeah, that was, as I said, that was, you know, larger than we were expecting based on vaccination coverage to date, because other surveys that have been conducted to look at vaccine uptake show that only about a third of girls have received the complete three-dose series. HPV vaccination is a three-dose series. Mm. But about 53% had received at least one dose.
So what does this tell you? I mean, the fact that the vaccination seems to be hugely effective, and yet only a third of young teenage women getting the full vaccination.
Well, first of all, we looked to see if there were other things that could have caused this decrease, and one thing could have been a change in sexual activity between these two periods, and so less girls and women would be getting exposed. And based on the data in our study, we did not find any decrease in sexual activity. The same percentage of girls did report being sexually active, and they reported a similar number of lifetime sexual partners. Now, there could have been factors that we were not able to evaluate that could have accounted for the decrease, factors related to sexual activity. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that there could be an impact from less than a complete three-dose series, because, as I said, surveys in the U.S. that have looked at vaccine coverage have shown that about 50% have received at least one dose. So if not everyone has received the complete three-dose, but there is some protection from less than a three-dose series, that could be accounting for some of this. And also something we call herd immunity, and that means that even if there is an impact, an indirect impact from vaccination that will cause, that result in a decrease in circulating HPV so that people are less likely to be exposed to HPV.
And when you talk about herd immunization, say a little more about that. That's because the people who are vaccinated are likely part of the population that is perhaps more sexually active. So the impact of that vaccination is sort of is larger than the actual numbers that are vaccinated. Is that correct?
Two separate things. Herd immunity in general just means that those people that are vaccinated are protecting those that are unvaccinated, because there's less, and this happens with a lot of vaccines due to that are protecting against other infections as well, that those who are vaccinated are protecting those who are unvaccinated because there's less circulating virus or bacteria, whatever we're talking about. But in this situation for HPV, it does appear that those who are vaccinated may have been in a higher risk group, so they would have a greater impact in terms of decreasing the prevalence of HPV.
Yeah. I got it. But with the news that this vaccine is apparently so effective, and that only one in three of teenage girls are using the full dosage, is this a bit of a wake-up call that might be termed get vaccinated? It can only do you good. It's a real barrier against cancer.
Exactly. We feel like this information will be very helpful for providers and parents to let them know how effective this vaccine is. That's not completely surprising, because the clinical trials that were done before the vaccine was licensed showed this vaccine is very effective, and one of the most effective vaccines that we have available. So the high effectiveness of the vaccine is not that surprising, but now we have data from our own vaccination program suggesting that the vaccine is very effective. We hope this will be really helpful for parents and providers.
A little bit later in the show, we're going to get into some of the reasons why parents and teenagers might be reluctant to embrace the vaccine. But what's your view on that? Why only one in three girls getting the full dosage?
Well, there have been some studies looking at that, and we've looked at, we've asked parents of girls that are not vaccinated why they didn't get their daughter vaccinated. And some of the main reasons are that they think the vaccine is not needed. They think their daughter is not sexually active yet, and some people have safety concerns. And there's this misconception that, you know, you should wait until someone is sexually active before you get them vaccinated. But, of course, to protect people against any disease, we want to get them vaccinated before they're exposed.
Hmm. So we've been talking about teenage girls, of course, and HPV. What about more studies in terms of the future? In particular, I wanted to ask about boys. Are we going to get to the day where it's going to be recommended that boys get this vaccination as well?
Yeah. Well, it actually is recommended for boys. So when the vaccine was first licensed, it was only licensed for for girls and women, and that was in 2006, and the recommendation at that time was for routine vaccination of girls at 11 or 12 years of age and through age 26 if you hadn't been vaccinated before. And then data became available later on the effectiveness of the vaccine in boys, and it was licensed for boys. And in 2011, there was a routine recommendation was extended to boys. So now the recommendation in the U.S. is for routine vaccination of girls and boys at 11 or 12 years of age.
Dr. Lori Markowitz is an epidemiologist and the lead researcher for the HPV vaccine working group at the CDC. Dr. Markowitz, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
In March, Christina Rosa, a Minnesota parent, told Fox News station KMSP that she was concerned that getting her child vaccinated would send the wrong message.
In some ways, I think that it's, you know, it is beneficial, but then sometimes I feel like, are we promoting the wrong thing? You know, are we saying just, you know, go ahead and do what you want?
And last October in Los Angeles, speaking with CBS News, 15-year-old Alexis Rubio said that her mother was happy to get her the vaccine. And as for any symptoms following the shot, Alexis said she was all clear.
The doctor told my mom, explained to her how it could prevent cancer in the future and STDs. And my mom, like, agreed to get it for my own health. I hurt when I got the shot, but I had no, like, later symptoms at all. It was fine.
So two views there on the HPV vaccination. And now for a look into who's getting vaccinated, who's not, and why. Joining me from Cape Cod in Massachusetts is Dr. Rebecca Perkins. She's a physician and professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Boston University. She studied HPV for a long time, including the various factors that influence rates of HPV vaccination in teenagers. And Dr. Rebecca Perkins, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Denver, Colorado, is Dr. Amanda Dempsey, practicing pediatrician, professor of pediatrics at the Children's Outcomes Research Program at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. She also studies vaccine policy, including why many children and adolescents are not vaccinated. She also sees a lot of children in her practice. And Dr. Dempsey, thank you for joining us as well. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
So let me start with you, Amanda Dempsey, if I could. Your first response to this study, which seems to suggest in a very big way, these vaccinations are very, very effective.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting result. And as Dr. Markowitz was saying earlier, really goes along with the clinical trials that we saw before the vaccine was licensed, that this vaccine is extremely effective and has a remarkable potential to prevent HPV-related diseases like cervical cancer, genital warts, anal cancers, et cetera.
Mm. And Dr. Rebecca Perkins, same question to you. What does it mean for you as an OBGYN in your practice, the results of this study?
Well, I think it's very exciting because most of the women I see are obviously older. They're out of their teenage years, but the problems that I see every week related to HPV are usually after a decade or more of infection. So I'm really hoping that I'll see less business in the future.
Yeah. So talk about the other number that's less encouraging, I gather, from your perspective, and that is we still only have 1 in 3 teenage girls getting the full course of vaccine. And Rebecca, I'll come to you. Why is that the case?
So there are two issues. Starting the vaccine and finishing all three doses are not the same question. Many people are very excited to start the vaccine series and prevent cancer, and I think that's becoming more common. But people do have concerns about vaccine safety, although all the studies to date have shown that it is safe. And people are concerned about potentially sending the wrong message to their daughter. Or rather than decline the vaccine outright, they say, oh, not yet. We'll talk about it next year. And they wind up delaying it over time.
Yeah.
And which is a different question than getting back for dose 2 and dose 3, which are usually, it's more of a logistic problem, not a philosophical issue.
Oh, that's interesting. So do you see a lot of patients that are basically open to the idea of being vaccinated, but they just don't get back for that second and third dose, not because of any decision they made, just because, as you say, a logistical challenge, as challenges that we all understand if we're in busy jobs, busy families, so on and so forth?
Absolutely. In the parents that we've talked to, especially in the low-income and minority parents, where a lot of them, you know, don't have flexible job hours, it is harder for them to get back. And in pretty much every study, African-American girls, even though they start the vaccine at the same or higher rates, they aren't less able to finish. And I think that is primarily due to logistical problems.
And Amanda, I'd like to come to you as well with the same question about barriers to implementing these recommended vaccinations. What's your take on why they're as low as they are?
Well, I would agree with Dr. Perkins. I think the two main reasons are people, parents, and young adults feel like maybe they're not at risk because they're not sexually active, which, as she mentioned, is a little bit of a misconception because the best way to give this vaccine is before people are exposed to HPV during sexual activity. And then I also have a lot of parents who have either concerns about safety or they just feel like they don't have enough information about the vaccine to really feel comfortable making a decision. So it may not be that they necessarily have specific safety concerns, but they just feel like they need to get some more general information about the vaccine.
And let's go to some of our callers right now, beginning with Abby, who's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Abby. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. The reason why I have a 13-year-old daughter and I had her vaccinated is because, and I even think I heard it on NPR, is that when she gets married and her husband is a carrier for HPV, he can give it to her. So I think there's a stigma attached to the HPV for getting vaccinated that, oh, my daughter's not promiscuous or, you know, she would never do that. But it's protection for the future so that when she does or decides to get married, that she's protected in case her husband is a carrier.
Abby, thanks so much for putting that point on the table. Dr. Amanda Dempsey, do you want to respond to Abby's case? Does that is that one of the reasons why people might be resistant?
I mean, I think that there are some parents have concerns about, as we heard earlier in this segment, about sending the wrong message to their children about their views on sexuality. But as Abby mentioned, I think she had a really great understanding and reason for getting the vaccine. A lot of people don't realize that the HPV virus can be harbored in somebody who's been infected for many years or even decades. So even if your particular child has not had any sexual activity until marriage, if they are married to somebody who has ever had any intimate contact with somebody in the past, there's a possibility that they could get infected with HPV and have the consequences related to that. I think another important point that I also tell parents is that it doesn't take sexual intercourse to get an HPV infection. It's a skin-to-skin transmitted virus, and so any kind of intimate genital contact can actually spread the virus from one person to another.
I want to ask you both about this. The recommendation, of course, is that girls as young as 11 years old get this vaccination. It might be a difficult conversation for some parents to have with a child that young. What do you recommend in terms of how parents should approach this? Let me come to you, Rebecca Perkins, first.
I think it depends a lot on the maturity level of the child. Some 11-year-olds are menstruating, and it's appropriate to, and are, you know, interested in boys, and it's more appropriate to have the conversation in terms of it being a gateway to open discussions about sexuality, because it happens whether or not you're talking about it, and talking about it is open communication is generally very important. On the other hand, if you have an 11-year-old who is very young, is not developed, and is not mature, many physicians that I've talked to will really focus on it being a cancer prevention mechanism for the future and leave the sexuality discussion to a time when that's more appropriate for that child.
Mandy Dempsey, does that sound right? Is that your approach?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, if you think about it in comparison with many of the other vaccines that we recommend for teens, we oftentimes, as doctors or parents, don't go into a long explanation about what the vaccine is actually preventing. We just say these are the vaccines that you need right now to stay healthy. So I've had a lot of parents and approach the topic more in a general way, saying, you know, these are the three or four vaccines that your child needs today, and these are what we're going to get to make them healthy. And then, of course, there's always a possibility of using that as a stepping off point for a discussion about the family's views of sexuality, but it doesn't necessarily have to occur. I think in a lot of cases, just a general statement that these are the vaccines that are needed is enough.
Mm. Let's go to a couple of more callers. Sharla is calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, Sharla. You're on the air.
Hello, Anthony. Thank you for you all having this conversation. I think it's very important. I have a 17-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter, and I have been procrastinating, getting them vaccinated, mostly waiting for more data like this and more safety evaluations. And I've been in a dilemma myself. My gynecologist, who's been practicing almost 40 years, has two young, well, teenage boys, and I found it very interesting that he said he had both of his sons vaccinated, and his exact words were to protect women in general. And I thought that was really admirable. And I think we need to take that approach. But on the other hand, and I'm going to throw this out there, and I have not verified it, so I apologize if it's completely inaccurate, but it is out there, so we need to address it. On Facebook, I saw this week that Japan has decided not to allow HPV vaccines for their daughters. Is that true? And if so, why?
Charlotte, it's a great question. Rebecca or Mandy, I'm not sure who wants to take that question, but do we know anything about what Charlotte's talking about with regard to Japan?
This is Amanda Dempsey. I can address that. So the caller is correct. Japan has temporarily suspended their HPV vaccination program, and the reason for that is they have had a few cases of reported what's called regional pain syndrome, which essentially means that there's a larger than expected degree of pain and sometimes some numbness or tingling at the injection site that they want to investigate in their country. Now, that being said, we have an extremely robust vaccine safety mechanism to capture any types of side effects like that in this country. And when Japan decided to suspend their vaccination program while investigating this issue, our group here in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention went back and looked at the safety data, of which we have several years now and multiple millions of doses that we can actually look at for safety. And they found that there was nothing in our data to suggest that there was a strong association between the vaccine and this concern that the Japanese government has about it. There were a few cases of regional pain syndrome that were reported in the U.S., but they weren't at a level that was suggestive that it was actually due to the vaccine or a harmful side effect from the vaccine. And so our country, you know, has addressed this question specifically and felt like they have already assessed the risk for this safety concern and that there is no risk. So that's why, you know, we continue to vaccinate as we have been in this country today. Now, the Japanese government, although I can't speak for it directly, I'm imagining that they probably want to do their own safety investigation using their own data to just have peace of mind for their own country. But I do think that this health concern has been adequately addressed in our country and found to be really not an issue related to the vaccine.
Let's take another call. Julie is calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. I was calling. I also have a son and a daughter, and when my daughter was about 14 or 15, I, of course, started her vaccinations. And at the time, I asked about my son, who was 18. I said, can he get them too? And the doctors sort of were like, what? We don't have that for boys. And I was like, oh, okay. A couple of years later, my son ended up, he was like, I don't know if I got, he thought he had hemorrhoids, and he went to the doctor, and it was that he had developed anal warts from the HPV virus, and it had gotten to the point where he ended up having to have surgery. And luckily, I have insurance, but, you know, when I saw the hospital bill, it was over $10,000, and I thought, geez, the HPV, if they had vaccinated at the time when I asked, that would have, you know, been a whole lot better, and subsequently, they did vaccinate him, so Is it a different one for men than women?
Dr. Rebecca Perkins, let me ask you to take that question.
I will take that question. I just want to make one other comment on the previous question about Japan, which is that they primarily use Cervarix, which is a different HPV vaccine than the one we use here, which is Gardasil.
I see. Important. That's an important point.
So sorry. Now to answer your question, could you repeat the question one more time?
Go ahead, Julie.
Sure. I was just wondering why at the time, you know, a couple of years back, the doctors would have acted sort of baffled at me asking if my son could get it as well. But then, you know, last year he did end up getting the series of shots. And I just wondered what the
what that might have been.
So that really had to do with when the trials were completed. So the initial trials were done in women with the endpoint of cervical dysplasia, and then the trials were ongoing in men, but were started later and therefore finished later. And it did show that the vaccine, and it is the same vaccine, did work for genital warts in men just as well as women. And that allowed a permissive recommendation in 2009, which meant that it was FDA approved and young men could get it, but the insurance often didn't cover it. So a lot of doctors didn't recommend it because then their patients got bills or they were left financially responsible for the doses. And then in 2011, as we said earlier, it was given the stronger recommendation because the trial showed that it could prevent the precursors of anal cancers in men. And so then you had a cancer reason for vaccinating men, which allowed it to get that stronger recommendation, which puts it into routine use and, equally importantly, puts it into routine insurance coverage as well.
Amanda, let me ask you, we asked about sort of the best way to talk to very young kids. What about parents who might be concerned that urging their kids, deciding that their kids should get vaccinated, is sending a signal that, it's okay to have sex?
Mm-hmm. I do get that question sometimes in my own clinical practice. And what I usually try to tell parents is two things. First, I explain to them that for the most part, they have embedded their values throughout their child's lifetime, and that, there's not any really strong reason to believe that by getting a vaccine you're going to undo the years and years of moral values that you've instilled on your child. The second thing I often tell them is that, this can actually be an entree into a conversation to really highlight those values one more time. So instead of being concerned about potentially sending the wrong message, you can actually use it as a conversation starter, saying, I'm giving you this vaccine to protect your health, but that doesn't mean I think it's okay for you to have sex.
Got it. An opportunity instead of a risk. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the cancer-causing sexually transmitted infection, HPV, and how we can get rid of it. And let's go right back to some of our callers. Paul is calling from Stony Brook, New York. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi there, Anthony. I'm a 20-year-old male, and I was advised by my doctor during just a regular checkup to get the HPV vaccine. And I went through and got the first shot. And then due to just, hectic schedule busyness, I've never gone back to get the second two. And I'm really interested to know if there's any research on how a partial vaccination affects the vaccine, especially for men, and how important is it that I go back for the next two?
Rebecca Perkins, let me come to you with that. Thanks for the question, Paul. It's a good one.
So the efficacy is definitely best with three doses, but you never have to restart the series. So you can still go back and get the other two. And the insurance coverage is definitely there through age 21. So I would hop right over to your doctor's office before your 22nd birthday. In terms of the efficacy with partial dosing, there aren't a lot of studies of incomplete dosing because we want everyone to get all three doses. There may be some protection, but it's probably not as good as with all three.
All right, Paul, we thank you for that call. Let's go to Barry, who's calling from Athens, Georgia. Hi, Barry, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it. What's on your mind?
Well, I think there's a one-ton elephant in the room, and that is this myth that's been going around for a decade or two amongst a significant segment of the population that vaccines are dangerous, especially among parents with young children. And because of that, I think we've had significant outbreaks of measles and whooping cough in recent years. I think the results of this study reinforce the need for parents to get their children vaccinated, not just for HPV, but for the whole range of vaccines that are usually given to small children. Vaccinations are not dangerous. They don't cause autism.
No, Barry, we got your point, and I don't want to launch this conversation into a big debate about concerns about autism and vaccinations in general, but I do want to take your point and put it on the table and ask you, Mandy Dempsey, about this. And in terms of your work with reasons that people aren't getting vaccinated, is Barry right? Is this sort of the big elephant in the room, just this general fear of vaccinations? To what extent do you hear that?
Yeah, I think Barry brings up a good point. I mean, there is evidence to suggest that the number of parents, especially of parents of young children who are concerned or hesitant to get their children vaccinated, has been growing over the last decade. And I'm sure that that probably trickles down into the HPV vaccine. I will say, though, however, that the parents that I encounter tend to have different concerns than the parents of younger children. Parents of younger children often are concerned about, as Barry mentioned, autism or some chronic health issues related to vaccination. And that seems to be less prominent among parents of adolescents who would be the target for this vaccine.
Hmm. Rebecca, related to this, I want to go back to this fraction, 1 in 3 teenage girls who get the vaccine. How does that compare to other countries from which there's research on this topic?
Poorly, in a word. In the UK and in Australia, they offer, and parts of Canada, they offer vaccinations through the schools, which is different than a school mandate, which is the way we have here. Many, you have to go to your doctor and get the vaccine and then show up with documentation that you've received it. But in the UK and Australia, they actually offer the vaccine in the school. So there is no issue with trying to get your child, your teenager who may be involved in sports and other conflicts, trying to get them into the doctor 3 times. And these countries have vaccination rates around 80% of complete doses for girls.
80%. So that's quite a high level of compliance. Well, Amanda Dempsey, let me ask you about the point that Rebecca raised, and that is, this is a long process to get this vaccine. Not so easy for busy families. You have to take your child out of school, give them a shot, and then do it 2 more times. And for a lot of parents, that's not so easy. So what do your patients do? What do you recommend for them to get over that logistical barrier, I guess?
Well, our practice, as well as a lot of practices, have some specific ways to get the second and third doses of HPV vaccine that are more convenient. So, for example, we offer immunization-only appointments, which are generally only about 5 to 10 minutes long. You don't see a doctor at that visit. You basically just come in, the nurse gives you your vaccine, and then you go. Some practices also will offer vaccination services after regular business hours because they realize that teens have difficulty sometimes, you know, taking time out of their schedule, or parents do, to bring their kids in. So there's multiple ways to do this, but I think that what we're hearing is, because there's 3 doses and we don't have a school-based system for vaccination, that's all the more reason to go ahead and start early, because you want to make sure that you try to get all 3 of those doses into these children before they become exposed to HPV.
Rebecca, we have about a minute to go, and I'm really intrigued by one piece of information that I wanted to ask you about, and that is the differences in demographics. More Hispanic teen girls are getting vaccine than white teens. Why is that? Any theories as to why?
So that is something that I have thought about a lot, and a lot of the Hispanics in the United States will be immigrants from Mexico. About 2/3 of our Hispanic population are first or second generation Mexican immigrants. And in Mexico and many low resource countries, cervical cancer is the leading cause of cancer death for women. So their mother, their grandmother will know personally someone who died of this disease. And so vaccinating against cervical cancer becomes very important. Also, it actually isn't just true for Hispanic immigrants, but immigrants in general, when people are coming to this country from low-resource settings, they have seen children die from vaccine-preventable diseases, either in their own lifetime or, again, the mothers or grandmothers will remind them of a time when measles killed many children in their country. Hmm. So vaccines are not a negative. Vaccines are a positive. And I think that the HPV vaccine is, we're seeing higher rates in the Hispanic population for both those reasons.
Very interesting. Amanda, I want to give the last word to you. What's next? I mean, as you look down the road, are you optimistic about sort of the future? Can we knock this out altogether, HPV?
Well, I think it's probably unrealistic to think we're going to knock HPV out altogether. We know that there are about 15 to 20 strains of HPV that can cause cancers, and this vaccine protects against two of the most common cancer-causing strains of HPV that account for about 70% of cases of cervical cancer. So, you know, the likelihood of completely eradicating HPV is low until we have a vaccine that would cover all of the HPV cancer-causing types. So I think it's really important that people recognize this and still continue to get their routine pap smear screenings if there are women, and be vigilant that even though they've been vaccinated, there's still a chance, although much smaller than if they hadn't been vaccinated, that they could have an HPV-related illness.
Dr. Amanda Dempsey, she's a pediatrician and professor of pediatrics at the Children's Outcomes Research Program at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Mandy, thanks so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Dr. Rebecca Perkins, physician and professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Boston University. Rebecca, thank you for your help today as well.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, stay with us in a moment. Bill Gates, big investment in his search for a better condom. Stay with us. This is On Point. Well, it's hardly news, but it's worth restating for the context of this next story. The safest way to avoid sexually transmitted disease and unwanted pregnancy is to use a condom. They're cheap and they're very effective. We know this, and yet, still, around the world, only 5% of men use condoms. So Bill Gates is investing big money in a big new idea. Invent a better condom, one that's not only easy to use, but one that people will want to use. Pam Belloc, health and science writer for The New York Times, wrote about this recently. Her latest book is Island Practice. It's just out in paperback, and she joins us from Weston, Connecticut. And Pam, good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Anthony.
So tell us a little bit about what the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is doing with this grand challenge.
Right. Well, they want to develop what they call a next generation condom that could preserve or even enhance pleasure. They have decided that one of the main obstacles to men using condoms is that they just don't like them. And that turns out to be true, and condoms have a variety of bad raps, I guess.
to say the least, right.
Yes. It sort of depends on the guy and the woman, and it's kind of a big hurdle to get more people to use them. So
how does his grand challenge work? He's investing a significant amount of money, and it's almost like a challenge, right?
Exactly, it's a contest.
Yeah.
And so what they've done is they said, send us your ideas. They have gotten over 500 ideas. Not all of them are going to be, obviously viable ideas. And sometime in the next few months, probably in November, they will pick some winners. They're going to give them $100,000 each. And then if they make their case that they, can really try to make this happen, they could get up to $1 million each.
Mm.
And they're looking for things like new designs and new materials. This contest is not so much looking at another issue that people sometimes look at, which is, let's just make them fun. Let's just make, take a plain old condom, but let's market it in a fun way, or let's give it, some flavors or some colors, or, glow in the dark, or, mm-hmm. The Obama condom stimulus package is out there with an image of the president giving two thumbs up on the condom. A lot of those things have already been tried, and
This is a real sort of more serious redesign of,
exactly.
of the condom. So what are some of the ideas that you've seen come out of this contest?
Yeah, well, we don't know specifically with the contest because they're keeping, you know, that under wraps. But what we do know is that, you know, there have been efforts over time to try to address several issues that men repeatedly raise. So, and then there are some new ones now that are coming out to try to address those as well. So one big issue is the fit. People say that they're tight and that they dull sensation. And so there have been efforts in the past, and there's a new one now, to make one that is loose-fitting, the idea being that not only is it not tight, but that supposedly the extra material can sort of enhance sensation because it adds friction. And there's a new one out that's not yet approved. It'll probably take a couple of years, but it's in clinical trials, called the Origami Condom, that is sort of designed. It looks like it's sort of pleated like an accordion, and it's loose. And that's one of its objectives. And it's also made of a different material. Most condoms have historically been made of latex, which is good because it's stretchy. But women have preferred another kind of material called polyurethane because that conducts heat better. This Origami Condom is made out of silicone. I think it's the first time that's been tried, and that's supposed to feel a little bit more like skin.
Hmm.
Then, you know, another problem that has been, that people have tried to address, is what was described to me as the donning problem. How do people fumble with them? It's, you know, hard to...
The donning problem. You put it so delicately, but yes.
Yes. Right. So there are some efforts to try to deal with that, and there's one that is already on the market in some parts of the world. It's produced by a South African company. Its name is the number 4 and then SECS for sex, which is obviously a pun, but also intended to describe the amount of time that it takes to put it on. And it comes with its own little applicator, which to me looked a little bit like a plastic life preserver. And you sort of pull it apart, and there's no question, you know, which end is the correct end, and it can, you know, supposedly go on quickly. So there are a few efforts to deal with that issue as well.
Fascinating. So when are we likely to hear about, to see a winner and get some idea about what the winner is proposing in terms of a new redesigned condom?
Yeah, we think sometime this fall they'll name, you know, the initial winners, and then those people will get, you know, sort of a grant to go and develop their ideas further. And, you know, I think the thing to remember here that people kept kind of pointing out to me is that given that, you know, people have different preferences, obviously, there is unlikely to be a sort of slam dunk hit. What is more likely to happen is that there will be several different types, different materials, different designs that will come out of this, and that hopefully one of the major things that the Gates money can do is try to subsidize these so that they become affordable and so that they can be made available in an affordable way, you know, around the world, so that men have options. You know, different countries, different cultures may have different preferences. You know, different people in different stages of relationships may have different preferences. And so one of the things that kept being driven home to me is that we need variety and we need options. That
variety
are,
and
readily
options.
Available. Yeah.
Sure, and of course, hugely important issue. Pam Belichick, health and science writer for the New York Times. You can find a link to her piece, Getting Men to Want to Use Condoms, at our website, onpointradio.org. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
You can continue, listeners, the conversation. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.